Thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder. She's associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Gloria Origi. Gloria is senior researcher at the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris. Her work focuses broadly on interpersonal relations and the ways in which they are mediated by various social phenomena. Her previous books have been about trust and the internet. Her latest book is titled Reputation, What It Is and Why It Matters. It's published with Princeton University Press. Now, we all put a great deal of care into protecting our reputation, but the precise nature of a reputation remains obscure. In one sense, reputation is mere hearsay, a popular perception that may or may not have any basis in fact. Yet we often rely heavily on reputations, for example, when we're choosing a restaurant, a mechanic, or even a physician. And obviously, multiple sites on social media are devoted to helping us discover the reputation of various kinds of service providers. Still, we all know that reputations are manipulable and often are manipulated and manufactured. So one wonders if it's rational to care so much about reputation. Now, as the title of the book suggests, Gloria explores a wide range of philosophical questions about reputations, bringing together the tools of philosophical analysis with work in sociology and psychology. Origi presents a complex picture of what reputations are, how they spread, when they're reliable, and how we can know. There's a lot to talk about, as usual, but also as usual, let's start by greeting our guest. Hello, Gloria.
Hello.
How are you today?
Very well, and thank you for having me.
Oh, sure. It's a pleasure. Can you start us off, perhaps, as we normally do, by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a philosopher with a very bad reputation, in a sense. I'm an Italian who came to France to study analytical philosophy. So it's I'm a sort of a strange, weird philosophical subject or object with a lot of different sort of mixture of things, and so I moved to France almost 20 years ago, and my first book was on Quine, on American epistemology, and actually I think that an important a key moment of my intellectual career was the coming of internet and so the late 90s and the beginning of the 2000s, in which I was a young researcher, and I started to be interested in how this new ways of spreading information in order would impact our way of legitimizing our knowledge procedures and changing our way of seeing what knowledge is. So I became involved very very early with what was at those times a sort of wild area of internet studies, but it didn't exist at those times, and also philosophers were quite uninterested at those times to the subject, and now it is becoming a sort of hot subject. And my intuition was that something big was happening, not only for all of us, for our social relations, for our economical relations, for our way of living, but also for our epistemology and for the way in which we conceive and we manage we conceive knowledge, what is knowledge, and we manage our epistemic states. What was paradoxical, and which is still the case, and it's really something that motivates profoundly my research, is that in this sort of era of deep knowledge, or like in a society which is saturated by information and knowledge, we we need more and more to rely on other people in order to extract any valuable information about the world and about the physical world, the social world, and what is around us. So that was a little bit paradoxical. But the knowledge, as knowledge grows, we become more dependent on other people instead of becoming more autonomous as knowers. And that is something that brought me at a certain point to be interested in trust, especially from an epistemological point of view. What does it mean to trust in others in order to acquire reliable information about the world? Is it ever legitimate to do this? Can we ever be justified to trust others in order to get some information and some valuable information, that is some knowledge from the external world? So that was my way to my present interest in trust and in reputation. Reputation was part of the picture in a sense, and at those times when I started to work on it, it was a word and a concept which was really out of the philosophical picture. And but my idea was, well, people need reputational tags, reputational labels, in order to orient themselves in this deep sea of knowledge and information that we have to face. We are in informational dense societies. We are involved in epistemically oriented or cognitively charged activities most of our times. I mean, and most of our time. And so, in a sense, we need tools for in order to orient our searches, our way of filtering information, of filtering too many voices that are around us. And that was the intuition that I had in the mid 2000, I mean, around 2005, I wrote this book on my first book on trust and what was the meaning of trust, for example, in experts, and what was the change, what could have been the changes in our trusting or practices in a society in which so much information is exchanged. And it was in the mid 2000s. And then this brought me really to this interest in reputation, that is all this second order information that we need in order to treat, to parse, and to evaluate the first order information that is becoming too abundant in a sense in our society. So right. that was the autobiographical path that brought me to this interest.
Oh, excellent. So let me ask you a question about how the concept of reputation, before we get into the details of your analysis of reputation, sure, how the concept of reputation fits into this broader insight that you had that is now might sound like a commonplace, but at the time you had it, it was not common, which is that the communications technology, including the internet, makes us surrounds us with information that we couldn't would have had a hard time accessing before the internet, but that in turn makes us more dependent. Is reputation does the importance of reputation become enhanced in light of that expanded degree of social dependence or interpersonal dependence?
Paradoxically, yes. I mean, reputation seems a sort of old-fashioned word that reminds other ages, mm-hmm, in which we all had a reputation or a family reputation or honor. It seems to belong to a bunch of concepts that are a little bit old fashioned, whereas it has become so prominent in these years because of the density of our informational society. And I am deeply convinced about that. What does it mean, this? I mean, I start in my analysis and in my research, I have started with a sort of epistemological concept of reputation. That is, reputation is the social track that all of our actions and sentences and what we write, what we do, what we think and what we see leads around us. And so it's a track that then it is judged and evaluated by other people, and it creates second order layer that makes us able to orient ourselves in the sort of deep and thick world of objects and things and ideas and text, etc., etc. So in a sense, it's reputation is a social notion, it comes from social science, and it what I find paradoxical, and maybe this is just a reflex of a philosopher, I mean, is that usually the forms, the progress in knowledge, at least in our Western tradition of thought, goes with more autonomy. I mean, we are, the more we progress in our capacity of reasoning and acquiring knowledge from the world, the more we are autonomous. We find ourselves today in a very different landscape in which we, the more we know, the more we are dependent on each other. And so we have to develop new tools for knowledge, and that was the aim of my research, was just really, so we need the judgments of other people, we need the evaluations of other people in order to come to know, and how can we be a little bit more systematic in or rational in evaluating this sort of second order, the reputations that knowledge and information has, in order to use it in a way that it is productive and that in the end improves cognitive knowledge. So that was the idea. I mean, that is the paradox, and that is also the reason why probably at the beginning the idea was a little bit like an oxymoron, I mean, as a contradictory. I mean, I remember I wrote in 2004 an article, a paper which was entitled like Epistemic Trust, or Is Trust an Epistemological Notion, something like putting together epistemology and trust. And at those times, that really seemed completely paradoxical. I mean, how can you put together trust, which is a sort of social science notion based on social relations, etc., and epistemology, which is the domain of autonomy and cognition and individual cognition, etc.
So S knows that P.
Yeah, right. And if you want today, this is a mainstream notion. You have classes and you have courses and syllabus on epistemic trust and the epistemology of trust. There are books and tons of books on this, etc. So it has become clearly mainstream, because we all know that the way in which knowledge is structured is such as that we really must trust other people in order to know something. So reputation was in the same vein, a notion that was a little bit provocative at those times to put next to other epistemological notions, and then I've tried to transform it into a more sort of acceptable mm-hmm. notion in philosophy.
Well, wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about the sort of central conception of reputation that you lay out at the beginning of the book and then follow through. So you describe reputation as a kind of social ego, it involves the conception of seeing how others see us. So it's not merely just what others say about us. Reputation involves the first personal sort of seeing, given what is said about us, seeing what others see when they look at us. Could you explain this way of understanding reputation?
Actually, as all classical works in philosophy, actually, I'm a very eclectic philosopher. I use a lot of social science, a lot of literature, a lot of references that come from all, I would say, all the social sciences at least, and not only. But I consider myself quite very classical in a very, very traditional in some ways. So every sort of reasonable epistemology starts with a reasonable psychology, I mean, a theory of the subject, the knowing subject. So you're right. I mean, I start the book with a new subject, I mean, that is the protagonist of my book, which is the social ego instead of the classical ego or true self. And actually, the main metaphysical thesis of the book is that the difference between the true self and the social self is bogus. I mean, we cannot really make this distinction in a systematic and in a sort of clear-cut way. Mm-hmm. So who is the protagonist of my book is our social ego, this ego that has already interiorized the judgment of others in order to structure itself. And it is also the protagonist of many of our actions that are actions sometimes that are difficult to explain in mainly merely in terms of maximization of our subjective interest. We defend something that goes beyond our the interest of our self, and we defend the interest of our social ego, that is the social image that it is around, that define us and also that structure us. So I start with this subject, which is a rich, enriched subject, sort of empowered, enriched, a sort of subject 2.0. Now you would say a subject 4.0. I don't know at which number we are in terms of upgraded subject. But I mean, and this subject is a reputational subject. What does it mean? It means that basically we, each time we act, each time we talk, as we are speaking now, me and you, between Paris and United States, we leave a social track. This social track accumulates with other social tracks that we have left, like gravitational waves around the universe. Each time something happened, there is a gravitational wave that is produced. This is exactly the same with our reputation. Each time we act, we leave a social track. This social track, the cloud of all these social tracks that are around, is our reputation. What, and so this is a sort of avatar of ourselves that accompany us in our life, makes us make some choice and helps us in presenting ourselves, recognizing the others, and also, as in the second part of the book I try to show, also in making epistemic choices about the environment, like choosing a product, choosing a doctor, choosing a wine. You were mentioning wine, and choosing a good or a bad idea.
Right. So if reputation then is this image of ourselves that's sort of imposed from outside on us, that we then internalize, is it rational to care so much about these ascriptive attributes or this ascribed image of ourselves? I mean, we put a lot of effort into managing our reputations.
I think that is the trickiest part of the book and the most original. I mean, you're saying if reputation is this part, the sort of social opinion. I say something more in the book. I mean, reputation is not only the social opinion. It's really cloud of representations of ourselves that we have contributed to create. We have contributed to create. So we are not completely passive. We don't just have to passively accept the opinion of others or not. The opinion of others are created by us. But what is complex is that the way in which we produce this representation of ourselves and the way in which the others read this representation of ourselves is not linear. I mean, it's not a linear relation, which is, if you want, in terms of really theoretically, one of the most, I think, interesting contribution of the book. I mean, reputation is defined basically in economics. This is the only, there is a little bit also in some other fields of social science, but not so much. And in economics, is defined as really the opinion of other people. Actually, it is a little bit more. It is what we think it is the opinion of other people, and it is a little bit more complex as a phenomenon. So I'm trying to clarify in my book what is this more complex logic of reputation. I mean, it's not only the opinion of others on what we do. It is the opinion of others mediated by our own actions and by so many other processes, like the way in which some of our representation are recorded in the environment, in the informational environment, their perennity or the fact that they are more or less ephemeral. So all these effects distort our reputations, but are not completely random. I mean, there is in a sense, reputation seems something that is really uncontrollable. What I try to do in the book is just launch the idea that we need a new philosophy for this. We need a new epistemology, a way of being able to control this second order information about ourselves that come from this social information, let's say, with the appropriate tools.
That's fascinating. Can I describe a case for you and where reputation was appealed to at a conference I was at recently? A co-author and collaborator and I were at a social epistemology conference not long ago, and part of what we were arguing had to do with the way political profiles seem now to sort of bleed over all of, you know, one's personal identity or social identity, and that, you know, sort of in the States, you know, being a supporter of President Trump now seems to be a signal of all kinds of other personal features that one might have. So in the course of the talk, my co-author Scott Aiken surprisingly pulled out of his briefcase a Donald Trump Make America Great hat and one of those red baseball caps and challenged somebody in the audience to put it on his head.
That's interesting.
And there were not very many takers. People were like, I don't even want to hold the hat. But Michael Lynch, the philosopher, agreed to put it on his head, but then refused to let anyone take a photo of him with it on his head. And he explicitly said, well, if someone takes a photo, they could post it on Facebook, that a picture of me wearing this hat, and that will ruin my reputation.
I mean, that is exactly what I'm trying to deal with in my book. I mean, it's exactly this kind of examples. The logic of what happens here is very complex and very sophisticated, and we are at the beginning of dealing with this. I mean, there is no, I mean, I discovered that that was my book was the first monography on the subject in the philosophy domain. I mean, right. Because it's new. Yeah. I mean, it's new in a sense. I mean, we are social being. We have this social ego that is now in many interactions the protagonist of our life. And the way in which we deal with the signals that we send is complex and socially mediated. So the case you are mentioning is a very interesting case in which you have a stigma, I would say, in this case. I mean, that is very precise, that is sort of conventionalized in a hat, and you put it in circulation. I mean, you make it circulate, and so who's gonna for example pay a price or earn a reputation because of this signal that his or her is sending, in this case Michael Lynch, so the logic is much more complex. You know, there is a series of speak checks that you can do with signals that is very difficult to disentangle in order to know what you're doing with. So in this case, it was someone who was signaling. You can also, just for example, wear this hat as a counter signal or a signal that you're against a certain position but you have you need a way to signal, sort of, you need a meta signal that says that you're signaling in this way.
Right.
So, for example, you can say a bullshit or saying something that is a fake news, but you have also, you need a sort of meta signal that says that this is a bullshit or something.
Right.
You can be read at another level. So this is the kind of dynamics that interest me and that are complex. And I think that people don't have the means, really the epistemological means for the moment to deal with, because it's a new arena.
Right. It was impossible to wear the Donald Trump hat in any way that was at all ironic or challenging. It was sort of like to wear the hat. There's no way to – we didn't have the signal to suggest that the hat was being worn as a way of reclaiming the message or resisting Trump. Very interesting. So maybe that is a good way to introduce – sort of, you have a whole chapter. It's the third chapter, I believe, devoted to looking at the questions concerning how reputations spread. Can you tell us a little bit about how, you know, sometimes reputations, you know, go viral, sometimes they flicker out. How do reputations spread through the social environment?
Oh, it's a very complex issue and a very fascinated one. We have so many. I mean, reputations are a social phenomenon. Reputation is a social phenomenon, and it goes through and it is spread through social dynamics that can be more or less virtuous, more or less dangerous. It depends on which kind of social dynamics they are in. So I talk in the chapter you're mentioning, I talk about informational cascades, I talk about phenomena like pluralistic ignorance, I talk about gossip and the spread of rumors and all the sort of social configurations that make reputation spread and become more or less stable. Also, there are factors that makes a reputation transient or very stable. So maybe Michael Lynch doesn't need to be too anxious about wearing a Trump hat if this is a transient thing that maybe enters a cascade, but doesn't last so long. So you can deal with a, let's say, a bad reputation for a while if it doesn't last so long, etc. So there is a social dynamic. Each time there is a social dynamic. Ideas are ideas need this sort of reputational context in order to circulate, and the reputational context can be more or less virtuous, let's say, more or less positive in a sense. I mean, it depends.
Right. So do you have a view about sort of what factors make it? So sometimes reputations seem impossible to shake. Once you get a reputation for being a certain kind of person, or maybe it's easier, you know, it's harder to shake a bad reputation than a good one, maybe. Do you have a view about what's the difference between the transient sort of the kind of reputation that one can overcome and the kind of reputation that one seems stuck with?
That is very interesting, and also it is very new, because there are cases in which, and I analyze many different cases in the book, in which reputations stick and they stay with you, and other cases in which they are incredibly transient. And these cases are not don't go. I mean, I have a sort of the way in which I treat them in my book, it's not systematic. I mean, I don't have a sort of overall theory. I would love to have a sort of model of how these dynamics go and that could make me deal with all possible cases, but I don't have it yet. Maybe I will have it in the future, but I mean, it's complex. And so I start, even in the book, I start with a lot of case studies and examples, and in which you have paradoxical, for example, ways of dealing with reputation. And I think, I mean, in the cases I have analyzed, I would say also my work is in between, as we do it in France, I mean, in between philosophy and social sciences. I do a lot of work also in social sciences and in empirical social sciences. So, and one of the best example of vagaries of reputation is, for example, the reputation of doctors.
Right.
People, have you ever noticed that everybody think that they have the best doctor in town? I mean, everybody. Think that the doctor, and actually this is something that could be also let's say a possible fieldwork for social linguistics. I mean, just people, not only they say that they each time they mention a doctor, they reassure themselves by saying that he's a very good doctor or she's a very good doctor, which is completely absurd. I mean, we are in a very, when we deal with doctors, we are in a vulnerable situation. We have to trust a lot. And yet we are more trustful than we should be. I mean, in a sense, we raise our threshold of trust. We are willing to accept the, let's say, the good reputation of a doctor, especially in the cases in which we are vulnerable. Whereas, of course, I mean, in a sort of in a paradigm of autonomy, that I would say that it is the paradigm of knowledge that we deal with. I mean, a sort of Kantian paradigm in which knowledge goes with autonomy. It seems to be very, very counterintuitive that you give more credit in situations in which you are more vulnerable. You should sort of withdraw your credit and be more skeptical, in a sense. So there are, as I say in the book, and I try to describe in a more precise way, there are heuristics of reputation that are very flawed. I mean, like, for example, the more you're vulnerable, the more you you give credit to the reputations of people, and other contexts in which reputation can be less robust and be challenged much more easily. But I mean, in a world in which we are all exposed all the time to this sort of second order information, evaluated information, even about the doctor, what do I know about my doctor? I mean, the fact that she's a good doctor, that a friend goes to the same doctor, that she has a good address. I mean, stupid things like that. I mean, we don't have so many objective sort of measures of the relation between her reputation and her, let's say, real value. There is an heuristics that tends to make the reputation more robust, whereas it should be probably the opposite.
Right, right. So you discuss this in various sections of the book. Sort of the general problem then is, what can we do, since we don't have access to, in the case of your doctor, we don't have access to, you know, statistics about medical schools and various kinds of like, how do we evaluate the reliability of reputations?
I mean, many times we just don't evaluate them. We evaluate what we accept is the evaluation of other people, and that is also another mechanism that I try to describe in my book. I mean, many times we just don't take the time and don't have the means to evaluate. There are domains in which these means are the more and more available to the general public. For example, I can go back to wine at a certain point if you want, but for example on wine you have reputations that are quite arbitrary sometimes, and also now you have tools, even apps on your computer or on your phone, in which you can check what other people have already said, and so making a sort of data crunching and putting together other people's judgments, you can judge. But I mean, for example, for doctors, you don't have this. You just don't have it. You have very scattered information around. Another domain which is very interesting and was studied in France by a sociologist of economy that I cite a lot in my book, whose name is Lucien Carpic, is lawyers. Lawyers, you really don't have a ranking of lawyers. Mm-hmm. At least in France, you don't have a sort of clear ranking of lawyers that explains to you why a lawyer will charge you, I don't know, $200 and the other one $2,000 and the third one 20,000. I mean, these are the kind of range of prices that you can have on lawyers, and it is unclear to you as a non-specialist and a non-expert why these things, why these discrepancies, as in why, and so you use social networks, you use collateral information, you use many other good epistemic strategies, because I mean, in the end, these are domains in which you want to have the best information. I mean, and that have to do with the way in which you weight reputation.
Right. So maybe it would be good to talk at this point about one of the case studies one of the examples you use in the book, which is not one I was familiar with beforehand. So you talk about an academic who gets caught polluting, I think it's Amazon, with negative reviews. of his academic enemy's books.
And actually, the interesting thing is that this guy was a very well reputed academic. He didn't have any reputational problem, but in the end, he ended up spoiling his reputation and ruining his reputation for his passion for accumulating more and more reputation. He spent his night on Amazon, UK, to write very bad reviews of his competitors, let's say the other academics who were writing on the same subject, and writing wonderful positive reviews of his own books. And this guy was a very good expert. He's still around. And a very good expert of the Soviet Union. And he really didn't need it. So it was a sort of, a bad move or something. Something that is interesting. In a sense, it's something that shows you that we are all victims of this bad strategy, sometimes out of inexperience. We don't know how to. We don't know exactly how to deal with this with these strategies. That's a very good example. And he didn't, when he was caught, and actually he ruined his reputation for this, he didn't even know why he did it. That was something that interested me. That's why I mentioned this example in the book. Because in a sense, this logic of improving his social ego or trying to influence his social image was something done in a very emotional, passionate way. He was there all the nights, etc. On the other one, in a very naive way, right. Without any strategy. We have so many strategies about our sort of ourself, and but we are much more naive about our social self. We don't know how to deal with it.
Right. So, and one of the, I take it one of the interesting features of this particular case is that, he did two things. One was he trashed the other academic's work and wrote pseudonymous, he pseudonymously trashed the other academic's work working in his topic. And then also pseudonymously wrote glowing reviews of all of his works.
Yeah.
So it was he wanted to elevate his reputation in a way by, at the same time, demoting the reputation of others.
Yeah, but come on, Robert. He's a sort of victim of our times, in a sense. Because this guy, we can also mention him. I don't want to give names, but right. He's a very famous guy, and this guy was the victim of a new way of circulating information that is heavily based on reputations. Why do you read a book? Because you have heard about it on the New York Review of Books or another reputed journal. So not only all the information you get about, for example, a new intellectual contribution comes from the reputation of this contribution. And that is something that we know. This is the way in which I was teaching on Monday, and a student of mine just was reading a new book by a very good philosopher. And he asked me, do you recommend this book? I'm not losing my time reading this book. Just he wanted to be reassured that the author was a reputed, well-reputed author. But sometimes, we spend time, in our youth, not now, we're always on internet and youth in libraries, and you can have very good surprises. People who are not so well-reputed, but you learn something. But now, even the way in which research is made, in the way the cultural phenomena are created, are heavily based on reputation. It's very difficult not to go through the reputational sort of labels that even a cultural product or an academic product has, and be influenced by this. In a sense, he's a sort of caricatural character, because he was the caricature aspect is that he was a famous guy, so he didn't need to do this.
Right. I mean,
and on the other hand, he was victim of this new, I wouldn't say importance, but at least salience of the reputational dimension, this sort of rich embeddedness of information that circulates because it is in a reputational flow. I remember when I was young, I was studying epistemology, and I was struck by a book by Fred Dretske, mm-hmm. Knowledge and the Flow of Information.
Yes.
And if I'm, and now I hope I'm not too old, I would like to write a book like Knowledge and the Flow of Reputation. I mean, how the flow of reputation contributes to create what is a knowledge phenomenon. You know, all this collateral information that shouldn't be so relevant. I mean, we have this sort of idea of, I mean, that you can pry apart and disentangle what is just social information and collateral information and the true thing. I mean, and I start to think that these two dimensions are not so easy to disentangle.
Sure, sure. So one of the ways that you capture the philosophical upshot of the pervasiveness and the exaggerated role now that reputation plays in our lives, right down to sort of research and everything else, is a kind of play on Aquinian slogan. You say to be is to be comparable. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that?
Well, that's for me a quite central, ontological claim in the book. I mean, the book is very eclectic, as you have may have seen. I mean, I go through very different disciplines and domains, and still I consider it as a philosophical book because I have some sort of basic ontological and epistemological claims. And one is the one that you're mentioning about homo comparativus. I mean, a being that exists only within the comparison, within the space of social comparison. And what does it mean? I mean, I make a very general claim about this. I mean, that things, ideas, items, other people, can be understood and evaluated by us only through comparison. I mean, if I cannot, if I don't have a background, it's very difficult for me to evaluate, for example, a new claim in science or a new theory, or even the value of a person or even a value of a work of art. This is a comparative arena that is typically comparative is art. I mean, what does it mean a work of art today if it is not in comparison with other works of art, etc. So this is a deep cognitive way that we have to read reality. We need a background, and the background is reputation. What I say is reputation is a sort of social information that is the background that allows us to read the salience and the value of a certain phenomenon. Without this background, without this sort of collateral information, it is very difficult to give a sort of objective value of a phenomenon. And this is very difficult. It's delicate when you go when you insert this kind of considerations in the domain of knowledge, in which we would like to have a more individualistic, objective, and autonomous conception on what we really know. I mean, so in a sense, I'm challenging, without being a relativist, I'm challenging a sort of mainstream image of knowledge as something that can be evaluated without this comparative background. I mean, we need a background. We need this sort of game between others and ourselves in order to define ourselves and also to define and evaluate what matters to us. And this is something that, for me, it's very profound and gives also a different view of what is the subject behind all this. Who is this subject who strives for knowledge and for realizing herself, etc. Who is it? It's a sort of a complex character who is always interiorizing and internalizing what other people have said about him or her, and it is within this social dialectic that who we really are and what we really know emerges.
Well, Gloria, you've been very generous with your time, and I wanted to round off the interview. You've written a fascinating book on reputation, and I want to congratulate you too in that. I think that you've made a solid case for thinking that the next move in epistemology, which has already sort of largely taken up the idea that knowing is a social enterprise and that social phenomena have to be, but reputation, you've made a solid case for thinking that reputation has to be part of the conceptual toolkit of the social epistemologist. So that's fabulous. What's the next project? What will you do next?
Actually, I think that the book had two main questions that I try to answer in a very scattered and maybe eclectic way. One was, is reputation a sort of rational strategy for action? And is reputation a rational justification for coming to know? Those were the two main questions that the book tries to address. And I think that the projects in which I'm involved now are trying to answer to these two different questions. One is a big project I was involved after writing this book, is a dictionary, and this is something that is very French. You know, the French love encyclopedias and dictionaries because of the Diderot d'Alembert, so we have a long tradition of this, and this is it is a genre which is very French, and it is a dictionary on social passions. What interests me now is to understand what are all the kinds, the possible motivations to action that go far beyond self-interest, which was a sort of the mainstream character of social sciences for a long time, at least for the last 250 years in many social sciences. So there are many other things that motivate us that can be, and we have seen it. I mean, you were mentioning political arenas, etc., but pride, shame, reputation, considerations of how we are seen by other people, and resentment, etc., are other kinds of are other, let's say, motivators of our social action. And I think that so this is the part of my work that goes with the sort of the social ego hypothesis. There are so many other let's say motivations that can explain social actions that we probably neglected in a certain paradigm of social sciences, economics and social sciences, psychological science and behavioral sciences, and that can be useful today in order to understand how people respond to certain social events like elections, etc. We had elections in Italy 2 days ago, etc., in this apparently irrational way. Secondly, I go on, I pursue my epistemological project, and and you mentioned this comparative dimension, the homo comparativus, and I was trying during this interview to make the case of the, let's say, the importance of this reputational flow in order to make knowledge go through. And I go on with this, and I'm more on the notion on status today, and I think that the hierarchy of knowledge, the ranking of knowledge, the status of different knowledge, of different forms of knowledge, influences a lot the way in which they circulate. Mm. And in a world like us that is opening and globalizing, I think that this, the status of knowledge and the status of different forms of knowledge achievement influence a lot the way in which knowledge is in the end accepted by individuals. So I go on with trying to, in a sense, enrich this reputational flow with considerations about the status of knowledge and the hierarchies of disciplines and the hierarchies of information, and how this perception, strong perception of these hierarchies influence the way in which we come to believe. In the end, what I'm interested in is what we can really believe, and what are the social, let's say, the which is the institutional and social setting that make us believe things that are useful to us. I mean, at the time. So I go on. Also, I pursue the project in two directions. One is more moral and sociological. What are the values that, and the passions and the symbolic also passions that motivate our actions? And on the other hand, what in which way the different status and the different rankings of different information and knowledge impact our way of making a sort of a meaningful picture of the world.
Well, Gloria, both of those projects all sound very interesting, and I'll keep an eye out for them. For now, though, I want to thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on the podcast for our discussion of Gloria Origi's new book. It's titled Reputation, What It Is and Why It Matters. The book is published by Princeton University Press. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
Thank you.